afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. It's Tuesday, June 4th. We are here for an informational meeting for the purposes of hearing from Legislative Revenue Office about an amendment to House Bill 2164. In that bill, we will have two general categories of items for us to review and discuss and vote on. The one we're going to, the category of items we're going to hear about today are generally characterized as technical corrections to House Bill 3427 that was passed recently. These are going to be primarily technical issues. It's clarifying language. The intent of these is not to change the policy that was adopted in House Bill 3427, but there have been some issues that were raised since that time. Is this what the words really meant? Could this have been stated better so that it will be understood better by those persons affected by the bill? So that's what we're going to be hearing about today. At our meeting, which at the present time is scheduled for next Friday, we will hear about tax credits. That will be another amendment that will be presented to us. Senator Haas, do you have anything you would like to add to amplify on the purpose of this amendment?
Just many thanks to the Legislative Revenue Office, the Department of Revenue, and some of the stakeholders who have worked on some pretty dense and dry technical issues on insurance, banking, and the like, things that, whether there were drafting errors or things that came up after our votes, they're just necessary technical corrections.
Thank you. Mr. Allenick.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So what I was going to, we got this about 45 minutes, maybe an hour ago. I've had one chance to briefly go through it, but that's my intent here, was just to walk everybody through it and then to take questions as they come up. And basically going through this and talking about the bold language or the italicized language, the additions and deletions. So section one, page one, line 7 and 8, there's this language that you're going to see throughout here where the phrase of this act is being replaced by chapter 122, Oregon Laws 2019. And that's just the bill, because this isn't the act. It's referring to the enrolled version of House Bill 3427. So the changes that start on line 13 and then roll into page 2 have to do with definitions. In 3427, we had three sets of definitions. There was commercial activity, which was the main definition in defining the tax base. And then we had commercial activity of a financial institution and commercial activity of an insurer. And that was causing some confusion about how those fit together. So we reworked them into the form that you have here. The language hasn't really changed, just the structure. So that rather than having subsection 1, 2, and 3 be those definitions, they're all rolled into section or subsection 1. And so we have the reading from line 9, commercial activity means, and then you bounce down to line 13. I mean, lines 10 through 12 are the main definition, and then starting with line 13, it says, if received by a financial institution. So this is that definition. So lines 13 down through page, line 2 of page 2 are those definitions. They just got moved here. And later on, when we get to the different part of the bill, you'll see it deleted from a different part. So it's just a restructuring of the definitions. And then on page 2, lines 3 through 12 are the definition of commercial activity if received by an insurer. Now, this language has changed. It's not that same definition for an insurer. Here, we're basically getting at the premiums paid, or the income from the premiums from the insurance companies is a focusing of the tax base. So this would be one of those situations where the words did change, and this is a refinement of trying to get at the best tax base for the insurance companies. As you may remember, as the other joint committee worked through this throughout the earlier part of the session, there was the tax base on how to handle financial companies and insurance companies. So this language is different from 3427 and basically gets at the premiums being the tax base. Lines 10 through 12 clarify that surplus line premiums have to be for Oregon home state risks. It's just another piece of, I think it's federal law that restricts the taxation of these vehicles to only the home state.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Chris, one of the issues that came up was the retaliatory tax, and while the insurance companies would be paying more tax, and they're still going to pay the same amount of tax, the issue was, do we want them to be paying this tax to other states or to Oregon? And this corrects some of that.
Co-Chair Haas, that is something we're still looking at. We think it might in some cases, but perhaps not in other cases. We're still working through some of those dynamics. And it seems anything having to do with the retaliatory tax is just exponentially complicated. I don't want to say that it resolves the problem in all cases. I think there might still be a piece. And then we get down to lines, starting with line 13, now we get to subsection B, where it's the definition commercial activity does not include. And this is a very long list where it goes from cap A to cap RR or UU or something like that. It's a long list clarifying what is not considered part of the tax base. And lines 15 and 16, you see bold language where, actually starting on line 14, interest income is not part of the tax base. And that gets at the commercial activity. So if you have entities that earn income from interest, that's not the result of commercial activity. So that's not part of the tax base. Except in two cases, interest on credit sales, where that is the nature of the business, or interest income received by financial institutions, because that's part of the nature of their business. Lines 20 through 22 are another insurance piece.
Yes, Senator Vance.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, Chris, when you say interest on sales, would that also include service charges? So there's always a debate when you were when I was assisting someone in carrying an account, we always tried to call it a service charge as opposed to interest to avoid all the disclosures necessary with interest. So service charge.
That's a good question. I think it would include it, but I will follow up on that one, get some detail on it. Lines 20 through 22 have to do with reciprocal insurers and an entity referred to as its attorney in fact. And this is an example where these entities on the corporate income tax, they actually file together. And there are these transactions between the two entities that net out. And in the original draft, both of those transactions would have been included. So this just clarifies that these transactions aren't part of the tax base. It's akin, I think, to a unitary group concept where the main part of the bill exempts those activities. And this is just a very particular case in the insurance industry. Lines 23 to 28 clarify that receipts from hedging transactions are not included in the tax base. And this, we're mainly thinking of energy companies that their primary business is selling energy, whether it be natural gas, for example, to customers. It is their commercial activity. Hedging transactions aren't part of that activity. And the way we had defined some terms in 3427, it was picking up these transactions. So this is just clarifying that those transactions are not part of this tax base. So scrolling down to page 3, we have lines 9 through 11, which is a definition of compensation. Now, this language was actually in early versions of the main bill and got pulled out when the definition for the tax base got modified or clarified to indicate that it was the commercial activity of businesses. And it got pulled out because the thinking was, well, there was no case in which compensation to an employee would be considered that kind of business transaction. Some questions came up about that, and I think there's a piece in federal law that might indicate that, cast some shadow of a doubt on that. So just out of caution, it was added back in this version. Okay, on page 4, all of the changes in lines 4 through 14 are just the reference of this act to the enrolled version of the bill. And then starting on line 25, we have language that refers to liquor stores. And the theme, a part of these, where you can see, and for example, in lines 20 through 24, and elsewhere in the bill, that collections of, when certain businesses sell entities that are subject to an excise tax, they're collecting that tax and then remitting it to the state or the local government, that tax amount that they're collecting on behalf of the government is not part of their gross receipts or part of their commercial activity. Lines 25 down, the language wasn't exactly right for liquor stores because they're a different kind of entity. So this is just trying to clarify and tighten that language so that concept applies to liquor stores. Basically, and the language rolls over onto page 5, lines 1 through 4. And it refers to the amounts paid to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. This is the alcohol markup. So that part, it's a markup, it's not a tax, so the language is just a little bit different. Then on lines 9 and 10, that paragraph from line, starting on line 5, refers to the receipts of the marijuana tax. And the bold language on lines 9 and 10, just add any to this. Again, we're still talking about the items that are not part of commercial activity. It adds to the list local retail taxes, not just the state marijuana tax. And then lines 11 and 12 refer to meals taxes of local governments. That was just an item that was missed in the original version of the bill. The two that I'm aware of are Ashland and Yakutsk. So just it excludes that tax. So moving on to page 6. So now we've gone through the alphabet and we're up to EE now, lines 13 and 14. And this is the exemption for receipts from the wholesale or retail sale of.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Chris, how are gratuities handled in that restaurant piece? Mm-hmm. Gratuities on this, when you pay for your meal, you put whatever it is on there as a gratuity. Is that excluded?
I would think it would be excluded, but I can look into adding that language explicitly.
Thank you.
Mr. Alanak, would that be covered under acting as an agent collecting money for someone else? We do have language in, what is it, J? It might be covered there.
It potentially could. That section does. And so J is, well, we haven't gotten to that part of the bill, but that's that broad language that refers to that agent.
And it might be acting as an agent collecting money for someone else.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, we're on page 6, lines 13 and 14.
Mark. Yes.
I'm sorry, Chris.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I want to go back to line 13 on where the receipts from wholesale or retail sale of groceries or fruits, vegetables. The groceries definition is pretty clear and exhaustive, being that you're referencing here. And all of those things that you're mentioning, again, are included within the groceries. Why are we restating it?
The clarification here is that to my understanding, these products can't actually go from a wholesaler. They have, there has to be something done to them before they can be sold at the retail level. So the exemption that's here on line 13 is the wholesale and retail sale. And so for some of these products, milk, for example, can't be sold unpasteurized. So something has to be done to it. So you have the milk going from the farm, the dairy, to not to a wholesaler, but to an entity that does the pasteurizing, I think. This is the way I've conceptualized it. And then it can go to the retail store. So it doesn't get picked up in that wholesale level, that chain. That's part of the intent.
Okay.
But if that doesn't, and I should say, this is just the first shot at this, and if I would be surprised if there aren't changes to this.
And thank you, because as I read through, when I looked at the definition of groceries as it's defined in the U.S. code, and all of these items were there, and I was just trying to understand why we got where we got to.
Part of the policy has been where the food, the entire chain of the food, and the two steps that are not part of the tax base are what we refer to as the wholesale and retail step. And somehow, for these items listed here, that they don't really fit into that wholesale definition. That's my understanding right now, but we can certainly look at it some more.
Yeah, I guess I would argue that it would, but thank you.
And then, so continuing down on page 6, starting with line 29, and then from here into the middle of page 7, there are just some technical wording changes. For example, on line 29, monies collected by a utility for is being replaced with or recovered for right-of-way fees. I think this might be the epitome of some of the technical changes. We're just trying to get the right words. And then on page 7, we have line 5, where by telecommunications carriers is replaced with or recovered. And then in line 9, the word for is replaced or recovered and paid into. So we're just trying to get those words exactly right about these charges that are not part of the tax base. Then on page 7, lines 24 and 25, this is the ag co-op piece, where what we're deleting here are the words receipts representing business done with or for members of, and replacing that with farmer sales to. So this is something, the ag co-op has continued to be a piece of refinement as to what language really works along with the intent. And so here, the idea is to clarify that a sale from any farm to a co-op is exempt.
Yes.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. And I have a lot of friends who are ranchers that would take exception to the term farmer. I mean, you know, they don't farm, they ranch. So, and if that could be, so I think it's kind of a narrow definition, because I want to make sure that the ranchers are included as a component, that there's a lot of opportunities that the ranchers sell their livestock to cooperatives. So,
farm operator. Cowboy worker.
That's fine. They would like to see that.
Yeah. Did you say cowboy?
You did.
Cowgirls are harder working.
Cowperson would be more appropriate.
Cowperson? Okay. The cowboys just sit around.
Thank you. I'll be quiet now.
Okay, on page 8. Lines 4 through 8. These are this language still needs some work, but this gets at subcontracting payments in. The intent here is in the construction field for residential property. But that's an addition here in terms of items that wouldn't be subject. So the goal here, or the intent, as I understand it, are payments from a general contractor to a subcontractor. So just that first level of payment. And then the the amount of that is still under review. We're looking at this piece for a potential revenue impact. And then lines 9 through 25 are being deleted. You can see these are the definitions I referred to at the beginning. Line 9 is the commercial activity of a financial institution, and line 21 is commercial activity of an insurer. So because the section got reworked, those definitions are being deleted. They got moved into subsection 1. Lines 26 through 29 get at the subtraction. As you recall, part of the tax here is a 35% subtraction for the greater of either cost of goods sold or cost inputs or labor inputs. And we kind of got stuck with this with structure because there were a lot of variations to the definition of cost inputs. Ultimately, where the legislature landed was cost of goods sold as calculated at the federal level. The language that we had in there by referencing section 471 of the IRC didn't quite get there. So we're just going for more plain language where it refers to cost of goods sold in the federal tax calculation. The idea being the number can be picked up off the federal tax return. On page 9, the only change here, lines 25 and 26, is that reference change, referring to the enrolled bill. And scrolling down to page 10, we have lines 20 through 21. This is the definition of groceries, which is in federal law, the SNAP definition, but it clarifies that it doesn't include marijuana edibles or seeds. So those would be considered taxable. And then 22 through 28 are the definitions for a hedging transaction that we talked about earlier. Uh, 11 doesn't have any changes. Page 12, lines 3 through 9 are just those reference changes. And then on lines 10 and 12, the definition that taxpayer does not include an excluded person unless that tax-exempt entity has unrelated business income. And if they have commercial activity from a business that isn't tied to their charitable status, then that commercial activity would be part of the tax base as well. Page 13, on lines 25 to 26, are just that reference change. Page 14, lines 14 and 15, that reference change again. And then lines 21 through 24, it contain language that simply states that a vehicle dealer can collect from a purchaser an estimated amount of the tax imposed. And it has to say estimated because the tax is not a transactional tax. So for any vehicle that is immediately, for any particular vehicle that is sold, you can't really calculate the tax on that vehicle because it's not that structured. So this is just language that states that the dealers can collect that from at least an estimated portion of the tax. Page 15. Lines 5 through 7, this section of the bill is talking about the subtraction. This is that 35% subtraction. And lines 5 through 8 make two clarifications. One, that intercompany transfers aren't to be used in that calculation, and that the subtraction is only based on costs or inputs that are attributable to receipts that are commercial activity. So if you think of a grocery store that sells groceries, grocery items, and non-grocery items, the tax is imposed on the non-grocery items, and so then the corresponding subtraction should be based on that activity as opposed to all of the activity. And then further down page 15, lines 26 to 28, the section 5 is just the, just states that it's the applicability piece, and it applies to, it says that it applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2020. And then section 6 is states that the following sections, 7 to 13, are added to Oregon law. And then what those sections are, briefly, is language about qualifying contracts. And I'll just point to, rather than going through every line, just point to a couple of key pieces here. On page 16, lines 22 through 24, state that the governor, in consultation with business, the Oregon Business Development Department and the Department of Revenue, can enter into a contract, a qualifying economic contract with a business. And there are various requirements. For example, on page 17, lines 3 through 4, there needs to be a capital investment of at least $1 billion over not more than 10 years to be able to enter into the contract. And there are employee requirements there on line 9, about 500 new full-time equivalent employees after completion of the project, or maintain no less than 90% of the full-time equivalent employees. That the intent there is to get at the notion of retaining employees as opposed to just adding employees. And then the thrust of the contract results in certain receipts that would be exempt, and those start getting listed there on page 7 on lines 28. And so these would be receipts by companies that are paid by the entity that enters into the contract. And so those amounts, so you have an entity that enters into the contract with the state, then they will have, I think the vision here is some sort of certificate that some of their suppliers would be exempt from the tax, because again, thinking back to the tax base, it's any goods or services sold into the state is the tax base. And so for certain companies where the transactions or the sales are made to the entity included in the contract, those sales would be exempt.
Yes.
So on lines 7 to 15, where it's talking about the full-time equivalent employee count, so do I understand this right? They can either add 500 new full-time employees or maintain up to at least 90% of what they had. And why is this equivalent?
This is language that, this might be another example of language that is still being massaged a little bit. The concept there is a lot is new employment versus retained employment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's trying to get, it's an attempt to get at that concept.
So I get that. I just don't understand why retaining 90% of your employees is even similar to getting 500 new employees.
I think the intent that stakeholders are trying to get at here is a potential downside risk. The timing here, because you have a 10-year time period, and depending on when you're making this measurement, it can have an effect on that. And I think we're still working on refining the language.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I agree with the senator's line of questioning. These are mega companies. I mean, which make up, a very small percentage. And I haven't read all through here. I apologize for that. But are we doing anything for small businesses to try to help them get in there? I mean, that's a driver for us. I mean, to have $1 billion. Capital investment, not that many people are going to come to Oregon to lay out $1 billion. So do we address any of the small businesses on this economic development scope?
In this language here, it's just the larger ones that, that can afford a billion-dollar investment.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Can someone help me understand the definition of what a qualifying economic development contract is?
The idea here, I'll take a shot at it. The idea is that an entity would enter into agreement with the governor and a couple of relevant agencies, and if they meet certain criteria, largely we're talking about capital and large capital investment, that would be associated with employment levels. So the driver there is the capital investment and the employment. And depending on these conditions, the $1 billion over the 10 years and the employment, that as long as they are meeting those criteria, any of their or their supply chain, the companies that are their suppliers, would be exempt from the commercial activity tax. And the exact receipts that are listed there are at the bottom of page 17 and the top of page 18. But that's the idea, is that the entity itself isn't exempt from the tax. So their sales, their commercial activity in Oregon would still be subject to the tax. It's their supply chain.
And the small employers are already exempt.
So there's no comment on the, there's no requirement for the supplier to be of a certain size. So those could be small companies.
Okay. So follow up.
Yes.
So a qualifying economic development contract, I'll just use the simplest example, maybe an enterprise zone.
An enterprise zone is a geographic definition. This would just be a company located in Oregon.
Like a SIP.
So let me ask a follow-up, because I think Representative Finley's really onto something here. If our understanding from the beginning was we're not going to change policy, we're just tweaking, doesn't this constitute a pretty big policy discussion or issue from the original bill?
I think this is one of the exceptions to those. The couple of exceptions that we have in here are the subcontractor payments in this piece. Now, there might be some policy clarifications there.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Marsh. Oh, I have a question about implementation. So as I read this in section two, it says increases its full-time equivalent employee count in each county where the capital investment is made by at least 500 new equivalent employees. Is that practical to be able to do that in each county? In particular, if your level of investment is at different levels at multiple locations.
Yeah, I think it's envisioning just certain sites.
Page.
Page 17, line 7.
Right. It's section 2.
So, noted. Representative Smith.
Chair. So, following up on my earlier comments, effectively we're making the first real change to the previous legislation in that this is a large carve out for those large companies that are looking to locate or expand in Oregon. Is that a fair assessment?
More to the suppliers of people building or expanding manufacturing
suppliers of.
The discussion that came up in the joint committee never made it into the bill. Went back and forth on how to do it.
Okay.
Okay. Got it.
So, Pass, thank you for adding that. The focus is on the businesses supplying goods or services. And in thinking about Senator Riley's comment about the number of employees, I'm also drawn to the section, I think it's just below it, that refers to wages, the expectation of something more significant than just an average wage. I think we can move on.
Well, I think that's pretty much the bill. I mean, that rolls through, there's through page 19. Mm-hmm. And this aspect is the last part of the bill. And then you get to sections 14 and 15. Section 14, page 19, lines 15, 16, to say that section 7 to 13 apply to tax year. It's 2020 and later, and then the just section 15 is the when the bill takes effect.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Chris, on page 17, about that 150% of Oregon's average wage, what is Oregon's average wage?
I will have to look. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 45,000 to 50,000. I'll have to confirm that, though.
Thanks. Thank you. Just a follow up. And so that term, is that for full time 40 hour week? Is it an hourly rate, or are we looking at is it an annual? I'm trying to figure out, is it calculated annually or is it calculated by hour?
It would be annual.
It would be an annual.
Full time equivalent.
Okay. Full time. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So just is this, forgive my delay in understanding this, but let's go back, if we could, to page 17 to line 28. And this is building on Representative Finley's remark about large and small businesses. If I take this correctly, the idea is that if you have a very, very large business and you're building something and you enter into one of these contracts, then those who are performing construction for you, or those who are selling materials, goods, machinery, or equipment for the use, do not get to enjoy payment of this tax. So what it means, and this, Chris, you need to correct me if I've got it wrong, is that great big business enjoys a cheaper means of growing than does small business. Do I have it right?
Yeah, starting on page line 17, you have the A and the B, and then going over to C, and this is the suppliers and those hired by the company that's entered into the contract. Those suppliers, whether they're doing construction or selling those items, are exempt from the tax. Those payments, now, those entities aren't exempt from the tax, but the payments related to here, because they may have other activity that would be subject to the tax.
Yes, I follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. And I see that it says amounts received by a taxpayer, not the person that entered into the contract, but a taxpayer from sales to the business that entered into the contract, mm-hmm. are excluded from taxation under the tax. Thus, the large business enjoys the ability to grow, that the small business does not. Anybody under, that doesn't, can't scrape up the $1 billion, is gonna have to pay, or the folks they hire get to pay the tax. Is that correct?
Correct. The folks that they would have.
So, follow up, Madam Co-Chair. Somebody needs to explain why we're doing this. I mean, this is a policy that someone's calling out. I'd love to have somebody come forward and say, why are we doing this?
If I may, Madam Chair, what came up in the subcommittee was a need for some economic development in the bill. But it never made it in the bill. And those conversations continued after the committee vote. This is still a work in progress, and this is the first swing at that.
Could I ask a question?
Certainly.
Why the $1 billion? Why not something far lower?
One of the aspects of the bill that we have already passed, and this is in response to what are we doing for small business. I believe the, if I remember the proportions right, about 80% of Oregon's businesses will not be subject to the tax because their corporate activity falls under the $1 million threshold. So the first $1 million is not taxed. So the vast majority of Oregon businesses are not subject to this to start with.
Madam Chair, a question. Mm-hmm. The $1 million is a, and sadly for Oregon, an extraordinarily modest number. I wish we had many more businesses, other than the 20% you refer to, that enjoy gross receipts in excess of that million. Takes about two employees and one boss to generate about $1 million on the average. That's the small business that enjoys this carve out that you just mentioned. Those who are larger, it takes almost no time at all to get to larger. Three employees and one boss is the average. And I got that information from my famous cousin Clint, who supplied it for me because he's done so many tax returns for businesses of this nature. I would just say that there's a whole bunch of businesses over that $1 million, because if I recall correctly, 95% of Oregon's business is small and 5% is large. Again, taken from cousin Clint's almanac. So I'm worried that the comparison of the $1 billion business to those below the million is interesting, but it would be more interesting to compare the folks above the $1 million, but below, let's say 50 million, because I think there's a lot of businesses in that space that are going to be very upset that they can't grow. We might as well take it right up to half a billion. But I'm just saying, that's where the action is when it comes to our state. So I fear that we're not treating them. If there's still an opportunity to change this, let's think about maybe reducing that billion significantly.
Thank you for your comment, and I have a question for you, or for Clint. In the definition that results in 5% of Oregon's businesses are large and 95% are small, what's the criteria that creates that ratio?
I'll find that out.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just want to say that Ohio does this. That's how we got on this in the beginning when we were discussing it in committee. And so some of this language, I don't know about the exact figures, they could be changed, obviously, but that's similar to the qualifying distribution set of language from Ohio's very similar tax. And again, the nod was here to do something about economic development. And so this was the first swing.
I also want to add that if I'm remembering the process correctly, there is also a stage that such a request or proposal would go through, and it involves getting a not exactly like a stress test, but a pretty thorough going over, not only by our own agency, but there's an Economic Development Commission that would have to review and approve such a proposal.
That language is on the bottom of page 16. Lines 26.
Thank you.
26.
Yeah. Oregon Business Development Commission. Thank you.
Yes. I appreciate that thought. I guess the question is, what standards are we going to give them to apply to that review? Do they need to do more than show up and say, we've got $1 billion that we wish choose to invest, and we're not going to fire more than 10% of our folks? We're going to keep 90%. And do we get the carve out? Do we give them more stuff to apply in? Because they're a good group. I'm glad they're there. I just wonder what kind of questions we are asking them to ask. Should we put that in the bill? Is my question really?
I think my first step will be to ask our agency, the Oregon Business Development Department, to give us an idea of how the commission makes decisions currently, what its criteria and standards, operating procedures are. And I think I also recall that those meetings are public hearings. Any other topics for Mr. Alanak? Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. I just have a minor question. From the bottom of page 17, top of page 18, where it has the A, B, and C of the receipts that are exempted from the tax. A is clearly about construction, so startup. C is clearly about construction or installation, so suggesting that these are startup expenses. B doesn't specifically reference startup. Receipts derived from selling material, goods, machinery, or equipment. Is that intended to be for startup or for the full 10-year, potential 10-year cycle?
Line 30 on page 17B?
Yeah.
I think it could be for the full cycle, although that might be a piece that we're refining.
Okay. Well, that's, we should be clear what we want. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you. I see no other hands, no other questions to make sure we understand the content of this amendment. Thank you all for your questions.
Can I ask one question, Madam Chair?
One more, yeah.
And so would you like comments back on this on Friday? Are we going to attempt to adopt on Friday? Or would you like comments in advance of that? Or I'm trying to understand the process.
I think it would be helpful if you have additional comments or questions to be sending them in over the next few days. On Friday, we expect it. See another amendment about tax credits.
Okay.
And that day will be pretty full for reviewing that list.
Thank you. I'll get those.
Senator Hess. I think our work is done for today. Thank you all. We're adjourned.